Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Michelle Skupski-Bissell. Michelle Skupski-Bissell holds an MFA in creative writing from the NEO MFA. Her poems have recently appeared in Poem Memoir Story, PMS, and Crab Creek Review. She also served as an assistant editor of the Akron Series in Contemporary Poetics from 2010 to 2011, and an assistant poetry editor of Whiskey Island Magazine from 2008 to 2009. Currently, she stays at home with two young sons. She'll be reading today from her manuscript, The Barest Rib. Hi, Michelle. How are you?
I'm great, Lauren. How are you?
I'm well. Good. We're excited to have you today.
Thank you.
So do you want to begin by reading us some poems?
Sure, I'd love to. This first poem is actually the title poem from the manuscript, and it came out of a trip to Washington, D.C., where I was walking and noticed the Washington Monument and how a man still runs this country. So that image led to this poem, The Barest Rib. This is how we celebrate, grill in the driveway chalked with cannons and flags, a circle of men watching meat, big feet covering the A, leaving only us in fading red. There's still an erection at the center of our country, a stone monument constantly screwing the sky filled with fireworks and a once distant moon, men walking all over her now. We don't know what we want, freedom or its opposite, another daughter at home on her back, stretching herself thin, fitting fingers flat between her ribs. She likes the way bone matches bone, not worried about the sins of flesh, that tender casing on any other animal men kill for. This second poem started from a statement of fact. I was 12 and I was fat, and I went from there. So this is called Picking Strawberries from Four Preserves. I was 12 and I was fat. There's nothing you can do about it now. You were the woman with manicured fingernails and a full basket. I was the girl with red fingers and even redder lips. You were not my mother. I was not your daughter. In strawberry fields, there are no mothers or daughters. You tried to wipe away the juice from my cheeks. I understood the bitter permanence of stains. I refused to eat more strawberries without sprinkles of sugar. You shattered the sugar bowl. Every time I swallowed, shards of porcelain lodged in my throat. Every time I swallowed, I refused to swallow. That is how I stayed whole. That is how I lost part of me. There is nothing you can do about it now. Now the strawberry fields have been raised. Now cinder blocks and cement speckle the terrain. A young couple purchases a plot and its brick split level. I am not the wife. You are not the wife's mother. This time I am telling the truth. The truth is every strawberry spawns nearly 200 seeds. The truth is I am one in 200, not one in a million. You were a liar. There is nothing I can do about it now. This poem is called God is One and Three. God is one in three, but we think in pairs. Because of this body cut like a heart from a sheet of folded construction paper. Because one arm unfolds into two, one leg into two. Because one testicle, one breast, unfolding, unfolds. Because there is always a man and woman. Because there is always man and child. Because there are always four older brothers and four younger sisters. Because no one thinks in pairs just then, four brothers removing belts. Because no one thinks in pairs just then, four sisters missing panties. Because arms fold into arms, fold into arms. Because legs fold into legs, fold into legs. Because of years unfolding into years. Because I am the child of the child of the. Because I am the daughter of the son of the. Because there is no word for what I am. Because there is no paper thick enough to hold. Because only bodies. Because only bodies. Because only my brothers and mine. This poem is called Memorial Day. My brother called it Mamorial Day. as if it's a celebration of humpback whales and hippopotami, when locals like the Fox family, clad in leopard print blouses and coonskin caps, flock to the zoo. Mr. Fox pays $5.75 for the panda bear balloon his son will let loose, fingers wild and highlighting the lion atop his lioness until Mrs. Fox hurries her boy on, not ready for a conversation about live birth, past bushes trimmed like buffalo, past marine life floating in a cement cove, to the primate building. There they find a baboon, red behind, pressed against glass, and a crew-cut boy, pants at his knees, poised to mirror the baboon's pose. His older sister scolds, "Stop fogging the glass." But what she really means to say is, "Joey, that glass is so thin and hardly separates. Like the lush patch of grass growing over my own brother's grave. Grass I mat down with my long torso. Grass so much like glass I can shatter and celebrate."
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Michelle Skupski-Bissell, reading from The Barest Rib. So, Michelle, I see a lot of duality playing a role in those poems. You have some humor at work, and then you have some very serious things going on. So how do you balance that? Is that a choice that you make as you're crafting, or does that happen in the revision process?
I think I'm not much of a revisionist. Let's start there. So a lot of these poems come out word by word, so they happen pretty much organically, I think. And some of them, it depends on where I start. So, for example, the poem that I read where I am, I was 12 and I was fat. Both the first line dictated the tone of the poem. So that was kind of humorous in a kind of bland kind of way, and it just went from there. The Memorial Day poem came from a line my brother actually said, and I laughed out loud, and I had to write it. So I think it all stems from where the idea came from.
Are you constantly collecting ideas as you're moving through life, or?
Yes, when I'm in poetry mode, and I have to constantly remind myself to taken the world around me in a sense that logs those kind of images and sentences and ideas so that I can use them, you know, as I write.
Mm-hmm. Do they stay stored in your head, or do you need to write them down?
A little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I don't write them down as much as I should, so the ones that I can remember are the ones that I use. Mm-hmm. I don't keep like a journal or a log or thing like I know a lot of poets do. That's not something that's ever worked for me, so I just kind of do it as I go. Sometimes I collect like newspaper clippings that might have an idea in them.
Mm-hmm. So I noticed too that some of the poems are very heavily driven by images, by very concrete images, whether it's, you know, this monolisk or this these strawberries. Do you feel attracted to certain imagery in the world, or does it just inspire you?
I'm more of a concrete scientific brain person. So I gravitate towards those kind of images. Emotions just really aren't my thing. Mm-hmm. So when they crop up in poems, that's a bonus. but I start from an image. And it can be, you know, pretty much anything as you've seen so far. It just really depends on how something strikes me that day.
Mm-hmm. So how do you build the layers then? If you just start with this concrete image or some idea that you have, how do you layer it? How's that process
for me? It's about the words. I will let one word lead to the next. So it may start with an image, but then the words guide me. So I'm looking for sound, repetition, the way the images might play off one another, references.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So you're not driven by narrative at first.
No, and in fact, if I go into a poem with a narrative in mind, the poem tends to fail, because if I feel like if I have something pre-planned, I don't give room for the art to work, and so I have to just kind of go in with an image and then go from there.
That's great. Can you read us some more poems?
Of course. Thank you. This poem actually came from, I was reading the newspaper, and there was a statistic about breast cancer rates in women, which are astounding, and I was so struck by it that I didn't forget, and I still haven't forgotten. It's 1 in 8. And so this is that statistic led to this poem. Illustration of lottery odds. I begin drawing small stick figures on lined paper. You know the kind. A circle and 5 matchsticks stuck together just so. Picture 25 figures per row, times 25 rows. I'm working with wide rolled paper on spiral. I leave white in the top margin like a sky above my multiplying people. Try not to picture them copulating. This is asexual reproduction. Each one a child of my pen, the ink black, their faces white, so no one can claim racism. Call me sexist, though, and I won't care. These figures are all ladies that I haven't yet dressed because I can't decide what they should wear. Typical woman, you think, and that's perfect. This will be a poem about statistics if you stick around and bear my puns. I must make this poem less heavy-handed, more light-hearted somehow. I don't give my girls' hearts those racy pumps because I can't draw that small, and even men have hearts. So I opt for skirts, petite triangles, cinching each waist and shielding all that is below. I know my choice is traditional and might pigeonhole my girls, so I fill their sky with 50 free pigeons. You know the kind, little cursive V's or arcs of cleavage from above. I thought about giving my girls breasts, 2 small circles below their necks. My pen could manage that much, but an old woman once told me it's impossible to grieve the loss of what was never possessed. So I leave all my ladies with flat chests to spare me the burden of returning years later to my paper and somehow cutting away the breasts from 1 of every 8 figures. I'd need the world's smallest scissors and a steady hand. I don't have one, not when I don't know which of the topless ladies represents me. I didn't draw a pen at the end of my arm so I could find me among the many in rows like an army. 12% of women will face combat. You know the kind. Chemotherapy in the body makes them bald and bony. Who must fight is random like a draft lottery for women. And not even I can escape, though I'm a mother and a writer and the drawer of this picture, that I'll now set afire because today the sky is blue and cloudless and full of birds that will not scare with smoke and ashes. Brave birds, teach me to puff out my chest. This is called Diner Conversation. They're gone now, she says. You can study now, she says. Define study, getting to know. Define, define, drawing a line around a chalk line, like a boy kneeing asphalt, palms flat on a red circle. Cherry, he says. Sun, he says, at sunset. Suddenly, I want those 2 old men back, brittle bodies settled into their booth, plates returned with only pie crusts, pitted sweetness somewhere else. My stomach, miles of sidewalk, eternity of sky. At the hour of our marigold skies. Before the sun, I rise, struggle into my clothes, the sleeves of my blouse long, hiding my hands. The laces of my shoes, dirtied now from many days of walking, are untied, flipping around my feet as I let the door bang behind me. I cannot call my ritual pacing. It is freer than that, this ambling up and down the road's edge, watching the curtains blow in the windows of other homes, watching the greens and pinks and yellows grow, colors encroaching on the road. One morning, weeks ago, when walking wasn't enough, when I needed my hands to work too, to touch, if not man, then something else, I bent, plucked 1 marigold from the side of the road, trapped its thinness between my palms, rubbed back and forth, its orange head spinning like a lover on the edge. I wanted to drop the flower, then trample it in the street, soil its color, but I couldn't, carried it back with me through my door, again banging behind me in need of fixing, retrieved a glass from the cabinet, filled it with water, took 1 sip, and another before settling the stem in the half-full glass. For days I gazed at it in the mornings, before my walks, lingered there by the door, torn between staying and going, feeling restrained. When the first petal dropped, a shriveled account of what once was, I found another glass floated the petal to the bottom. Each day another dropped, sometimes 2, waited on the table for me, my hands deft in collecting death. This is what life is, a slow moving from 1 container to another. until those men with sterilized hands and paper masks unzipped my husband from his body bag and millions of petals poured out.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Michelle Skupski-Bissell, reading from The Barest Rib. So I'm really attracted to that poem about the breast cancer, or the paper, the little drawings on the paper. And I like how that poem is very self-conscious, and you're referring to, I need to make this poem more this, I need to make this poem more that. So how did that happen?
That's common in my work. I'm very aware that I'm writing poems and that the poems are poems as I'm writing them. And so it's hard for me not to acknowledge that, especially when I'm manipulating the words. And so there are times when it feels necessary to acknowledge for the writer that I know that this is a poem. And sometimes it just happens. I think I'm really big on awareness, self-awareness, just in general in my life. And I think that comes out in my poems.
So you want the reader to know that you know that you're writing a poem?
Yes.
That's interesting. So, and I think that's also another place to sort of inject a lightheartedness to break up this, you know, really powerful imagery and statements. And then you interject this, well, I know this is a poem and I know the poem needs to be more this, but wait, we're getting there. So I like that choice.
Right. For me, poetry is about craft, and I like to acknowledge that craft. But it's a fine line between doing it too much, especially in a manuscript. When I wrote my manuscript and went through it, it was like a third of my poems were self-conscious. And that was something I kind of have to, you know, balance with poems that aren't, or trim or revise as necessary, just so it's not overwhelming, slap in the face kind of, you know, heavy-handedness.
Right. If it works for this poem or if it doesn't work for this poem, you have to make that choice. But it's fun to sort of do that as you're writing.
Absolutely.
I've never tried that before. Maybe I'll steal it.
Go ahead.
And on those notes, you said earlier that you're not a big revisionist.
Yes.
So can you talk about your relationship with revision a little bit?
I don't have one.
No. So it's mostly editing?
Yes.
So how long does it take to craft a single poem?
I don't know. It varies. It depends entirely on whether or not it's flowing or whether I'm really searching for words. Every once in a while, I'll get a poem that really, I'll take a line out and start again. But most often, it's replacing words with better ones that flow better, that sound better, or adding a line or taking out a phrase and replacing it with something else. But typically, I don't start again and go through it entirely.
Mm-hmm. I like the diner study poem too. Was that sort of a scene that you had observed, or do you do a lot of observation in the real world, or is it just purely fictionalized?
Vast majority of my poems come from things I've observed. Mm-hmm. I sometimes take them and then fictionalize them. For example, the poem about the strawberries, that was fact. I was 12 and I was indeed fat. But my mother was not really any of the things that I project on her in mm-hmm. that case. So I just kind of start with the image and go from there. Mm-hmm. I'm not really an imaginative kind of person. I have to start with the concrete.
Mm-hmm. So you really keep it true to sort of what the poem wants to be about. Absolutely. As opposed to like the facts of reality.
Right. I find if I let the facts of reality dictate me, I'm put myself in a box and I don't let the art or the poem come out and develop.
Yeah. That's probably a good point, because that can be stifling sometimes.
It is.
When you're stuck on sort of a narrative that you want, or a fact that happened, and then you can't.
And it gets frustrating too when I want to write about a particular narrative and I can't, because mm-hmm. it fails every time.
Right. And then you have to just take the words out that are working.
Yes.
That's really precision. Right there. Can you read some more poems?
Sure. This poem is called Remember the Souls in Hell, and it is a line that I read in a book, and I just started thinking about remembering and what that means. And so this is Remember the Souls in Hell. Remember the souls in hell, a monk once said, so I begin with a slow dismembering. Head from neck, neck from shoulders, each shoulder from its socket, because what shape does a soul take if not body? How else should I recognize these souls in the flurried circles of hell? My grandfather still wears a suit and bow tie when he shuffles past a line of ducklings trailing behind. I didn't expect the ducklings, the ones my grandfather used to keep cooped in a house built from plywood scraps and shingles, until the neighbor's cat caught his favorite, Francine. He shot the cat, blamed another neighbor for the bullet, and urged the remaining ducks to fly by chasing them with the mower, stray feathers and grass clippings floating on all sides. I didn't expect the ducklings long flown, though I expected my grandfather with the dime-sized mole at his right temple, the one I was careful to avoid, always kissing his left cheek given the choice. Now I lean in and peck him, a sign of what is to come, though I can't seem to raise an axe like the one he swung at my father, a boy racing through the backyard, around the old maple, around the empty duck hut. My grandfather in hot pursuit, because Dad was my grandmother's favorite son, got an extra slice of bologna on his sandwich for lunch. I think it's the ducks that keep me from making the first cut, the way they follow my grandfather around like a father. And so I go after one, trimming skin from sinew, draining the blood, duck after duck, until only I am trailing behind, ready to cut. But I can't. We'll keep digressing with these stories about ducklings dead now, roasting on a spit over hell's fire, because a poem about hell is not complete without fire, and I'd need nourishment after all this slaughter. I've been meaning to try seared duck breast with orange glaze for years, go looking for thyme and sage to season a side of rice, and find, praying below the blossoms of blood orange trees, the monk, still habit-clothed and hungry, the one who reminded me kindly to remember the souls in hell. This poem is called Abba Paul, and it comes from a story I read in a book by Kathleen Norris, and it has always stuck with me, and I recreated that story in a poem. Abba Paul. In the morning, he picks date plums from his garden, mumbles psalms as he chews juice of the fruit of the god slipping down his chin. He does not want to go home. He is home, 7 days from any man or market, 7 days from being what he is, one man among many. Out here, he is alone with his god, and someone must labor. So he weaves baskets from palm fronds, fingers so dry and limber from the under-over motion of each day. Each day, he earns the day's wage and prays, "My God, my God." All he can do is give things names: sand, cave, tedium, soreness, rage. All he can do is pile higher and higher his baskets of names, unable to trade, until he cannot move in his room stuffed full with weavings, until he finds himself, defines himself, creator amidst creation. Like God, he exists only through relation. He is what he is not, and in the darkness he strikes flame, ignites all he has made, the blaze casting shadows over what will someday be his grave. In the morning, he picks persimmons from his garden, scrawls psalms in the ash as he chews. Father, Father, may my fingers never idle and my lips always name. This is called Song for the Thief at Dawn, and I wrote this while I was pregnant with my oldest son. Song for the Thief at Dawn. In a city that is not mine, in a lot unlit and unlined, a lone car offers alarm to the sky, and I am alone by my window. It is glass like the beads I finger, glass like the hours I wait. All the while the alarm sings, its tune one I know though muffled, and all those trees like cotton swabs, their other halves in earth's ears, and in mine a pulsing song, its rhythm round and urgent, like my son's heartbeat heard for the first time, like my echo, the doctor with his Doppler smoothing the skin below my navel. And I, with my breath held tight to better hear my boy's voice, not from tongue and empty gums, but from slick valves, like a trombone blown for hours, like the alarm on this night that sings while I write the same song as my son's. And no one hushes it, for this I am thankful, because while it wails of peril, it also trills of life. these two dance partners twirling together. I can feel their twist and flutter, their dip and drop, and my water breaks, the earth ever greener and wetter. This is called Two Views of Watercolor on Canvas. There is a porcelain tub, white gone gray from years of high bath tide. The tub is full of water to the lip with water. An exposed ceiling bulb reflects yellow on its surface. A flowered house coat lies crumpled on the tiled floor, spectacles folded on the sink. There are no slippers. Where is the woman who drew this bath? Is she roaming the dark city with only slippers to cover her nakedness? Oh, sweet woman, darkness only covers so much. Go back to your home, to your children. Clean yourself and them. Forget about the one who left you feeling this dirty, this desperate. The streets crisscross in patterns she cannot decipher in her blindness. She is lost. Her bath is cold. In my painting, there is a window over the tub. Rain courses its pain. In this painting, there is no window, no door, not even a drain.
Thanks. So I find it interesting that you said you're not a very imaginative person, but yet these Abba Paul and this grandfather poem too had all this imagination. They were inspired by things you read or things that, you know, didn't necessarily happen to you. So I think you have more imagination than you think.
Those two are interesting that you picked out, because the one, the Abba Paul, that story was written out in full. Mm-hmm. So I just took the details from it. The other one, perhaps some of those things are factual. And I was able to work them in, but maybe I underestimate myself.
Yeah, you do, because you have to have some imagination to craft this thing together.
Sure.
So, you know, and I think it takes a lot of effort to take a story that isn't personal or from that you've experienced and turn it into a poem. It takes a little bit more imagination or a different reworking of the imagination.
And I really enjoyed that poem for that reason.
Mm-hmm. So can you take us out with one last poem?
Sure. And this is, as it stands now, the last poem in my manuscript. Has an epigraph, so is my word that goes out from my mouth. It will not return to me empty. That's Isaiah 55:11. When my own skin is foreign, I am alone. I should not say it. My voice makes it truth, sends it away. Truth, come down from that palm tree. Come back, sit beside me on the balcony, the edge of my world. We'll peel the fruit you bring us, feed each other delicate pieces of red, our tongues surrendering to their color. We'll sway back and forth on the glider, stare off into the ocean, all its blueness. This world arches and thrusts truth, arches and thrusts, one shade of gray, always giving way to another. Stay with me. I will love you.
The poetry of Michelle Skupski-Bissell. Thank you so much for being here, Michelle.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody, 90.5 FM.